From Pennsylvania to Nevada, Arizona to Georgia, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the future of Social Security was once again an election issue, and there is no doubt systemic changes are needed. Charles Blahaus from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University joins us with some ideas for reform. It was supposed to be a blue wave, but Republicans actually narrowed the Democratic majority in the U.S. House of Representatives. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Once again, pre-election polls dramatically underestimated Republican support. Eric Boehm and Robbie Soav of Reason Magazine are here with analysis. And Roe v. Wade, which essentially legalized abortion, was a decision born of desires to limit so-called undesirable populations. Dr. Paul Kangor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College explains on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Claims the Social Security system will run out of money in just a few years are unfounded, but there is no doubt longer-term financial challenges threaten the program. Charles Blahaus is a former public trustee for Social Security and Medicare. He's now a senior research strategist with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He is here to talk about those challenges. Chuck, welcome to American Radio Journal. Chuck, let's start when talking about Social Security. Your piece that you wrote for the Mercatus Center, you said in that piece that sustainable solvency will include a blend of eligibility, age changes, revenue increases, and moderation of benefit growth rates. All of those are politically difficult, and Social Security often is the third rail of politics. So, any thoughts on how a proposed solution to the Social Security dilemma can get the type of support in Congress it would need to actually be enacted?
Well, that's a great question, and actually it comes very close to my motivation for writing this study to begin with, because I think the typical assumption is that attaining solvency is all bad news, right? We have benefit promises that well exceed the amounts that incoming payroll taxes will be able to fund, and the process of aligning our benefit promises and our incoming tax assessments is an unpleasant exercise, right? And people think of it in terms of taking things away from people, and of course politicians don't like to do that. But what I've tried to do with my study is to explain that there is actually an upside here, that a lot of the things that we can do to make the system more equitable, more efficient, better targeted on people who need it, and giving fewer windfalls to people who don't need it, actually will wind up not only strengthening system finances and slowing the growth of costs, but actually enable the system to work better for the people who participate in it.
One of the points that you make is that in many instances, Social Security redistributes income from folks who have less income to folks who have more. Can you drill down a little bit on what you just said? How is it that Social Security does that, and what would the policy solution be?
I think the short answer is it's complicated, and there's a lot of different examples and fixes that should be made. But I think the first thing to understand is that Social Security is, at best, it's a zero-sum game, right? It's not a savings program. It's not a program that's building capital. It's not a program that is increasing our national stock of resources to finance retirement income. All it does is move money around. It transfers income from some people to other people, which means that no one can actually gain money net from the system unless somebody else loses that much money or more. And so when we look at the system, we have to think about, is it moving money around in ways that make sense and which serve the program's sort of social insurance purposes? Now, as some examples of how it does this regressive ways, one classic example is the so-called non-working spouse benefit, which is a very regressive benefit. It basically gives people, non-working spouses, a benefit which is equal to 50% of the benefit of the household's primary wage earner. And on practice, what that means is that if you are a single mother working every day for a minimum wage for an entire career and contributing payroll taxes your entire life, you're actually going to earn less of a benefit through that process than if you stay at home as a non-working spouse and marry a very high-income earner and don't pay any payroll taxes. And examples like that redirect resources away from people who need it more and give windfalls to people who need it less. And there's a number of examples like that throughout the system.
This is coupled with the problem, as you've pointed out, that the costs of Social Security are growing much faster than what the earnings of workers who are paying into the system are growing. So what can be done to address that problem so that we don't continue to take more money out as an actuarial percentage than what we put in?
I would say that there's a couple of things. One is that there's a method of indexing benefits now that actually causes our outlays to grow faster than workers' earnings. It's basically indexed to growth in something called the National Average Wage Index, which tends to grow substantially faster than price inflation. So as we're all living longer and benefits are automatically indexed to grow each year at this particular rate, what happens is that it imposes a much higher tax burden and cost burden on workers' earnings over time. We don't have to cut benefits per se, but we could choose a different method of indexing the growth of benefits going forward so that the costs don't continue to outpace workers' earnings by so much. That's one thing that comes to mind. There are other things that come to mind if we had more time.
Well, why don't we talk a little bit more about that then?
Another related to one of the points that we were just talking about how the system rather crudely and inaccurately tries to provide higher returns to people in the lower income end. Now, one of the approximations that is made in the benefit formula is that it actually doesn't operate as a function of what your wage earnings are every year. I mean, the basic idea behind the benefit formula is that if you are, that there's a connection between the taxes you pay and the benefit you get out. So it keeps track of your taxable earnings over your lifetime and bases your benefit on that. However, what it does is it basically creates an average figure for each person. It actually doesn't use your actual annual earnings each year to determine the benefits that you have accrued. Now, that all sounds very technical, but the bottom line is that the system can't tell the difference between a lower-income person earning, say, $40,000 a year for 30 years of earnings from a higher-income person who's earning $80,000 a year for 15 years' worth of earnings. In other words, the system doesn't really differentiate between someone who's actually of low income versus someone who simply doesn't work that many years. And if you actually go through the data and look at the people who are getting sort of the highest windfall returns from the system and who are deemed by the system to be very low-income workers, a very high percentage of them are actually people who have income from other sources, either because they are immigrants who got a lot of their income when working abroad before coming into the Social Security system, or because they're people who are married to a higher wage earner or something like that. Only a small minority of the people getting those windfall returns are actually households of need. So if we were to redesign the benefit formula so people actually accrued benefits with each year of their taxable earnings rather than this crude averaging, we'd be able to target benefits a lot more effectively.
We are talking with Charles Blayhouse, who is a senior research strategist with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He has produced a policy paper, Strengthening Social Security, an Analytical Framework. Chuck, tell us a little bit about Mercatus and where can folks go if they would like to read your research and learn more about this topic?
Well, Mercatus is an academic research center. We're affiliated with George Mason University. And people want to read my research or anyone's research there, they can go to mercatus.org, mercatus.org.
Charles Blayhouse from the Mercatus Center. Chuck, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, Election Day is behind us, although all of the vote tallying and legal wrangling is not. But we're going to take a look at where things stand at this particular point in time. We're joined, as usual, by Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, good to have you here.
Always great to be with you, Loman.
We're going to sort of let the presidential discussion for another time because there are a lot of moving parts there, and talk, Scott, about the Congress of the United States. Let's begin with the U.S. Senate. Republicans had a very slim majority. Democrats had high hopes of taking over the chamber, but a lot of the key races, Scott, Republicans were able to win.
That's right. The Republicans performed pretty well across the board in those competitive races. Obviously, there were some races that Republicans weren't able to get across the finish line. We did see Cory Gardner in Colorado lose to John Hickenlooper. And then we also have the Arizona race with Mark Kelly defeating Martha McSally. But Republicans held firm in these other Senate races. We also have Georgia runoff with Kelly Loeffler, the incumbent from Georgia, facing Raphael Warnock. And that'll be a big, big race heading into January 5th as we really kind of have this additional swing vote that can put more moderate senators' votes in play and create that sort of historical norm of a few key people swinging close votes.
There was also a Republican pickup.
Yeah, we had Tommy Tuberville down in Alabama. The Club for Growth PAC actually endorsed him in the primary runoff and supported him in the general election as well. We're excited that Coach Tuberville is on his way to the United States Senate. This was the seat that was previously held by Jeff Sessions before he went into the Trump administration to be Attorney General. And now we finally have a Republican that is back in control, defeating Doug Jones.
As of this recording, we have 48 seats in Democrat hands, 48 seats in Republican hands, 4 seats still to be decided, although all 4 at this point leaning Republican. So next week, Scott, hopefully we'll have a more definitive answer. Let's go now to the House of Representatives. Democrats had very high hopes of expanding their majority in the U.S. House of Representatives. The opposite happened. Want to fill us in on some of those details?
This is one area where the polling just wasn't as accurate that was publicly available. In the races that the Club for Growth PAC and Club for Growth Super PAC, Club for Growth Action were involved in, our polling was actually pretty accurate, but we don't release everything to give away strategic disadvantages and advantages of candidates. So we are always watching the way that races are moving, and we knew that we were going to be competitive in a lot of races. So Republicans actually added seats, and Democrats closed their gap on what their majority looks like. There were several key races that Republicans won that I think were toss-ups heading into Election Day. Some races really surprised people because of different demographic shifts in certain communities. And one anecdote of that is in Florida, where President Trump performed really, really strong. There was high turnout in Florida 26 and Florida 27. So we've got 2 Republican flipped seats there. And we also had a couple of flip seats in New York. These are areas that we have previously held in Republican districts. I think that some people were comparing what the election results would look like to 2018, but in fact, it was more of a 2016 model because you were seeing those more competitive Trump districts be pushed over the top by the president's voters' enthusiasm. So it was a good thing for President Trump in a lot of these congressional races. He definitely carried some of them through.
In terms of the overall majority, we're still a little bit too early to have final numbers on that. But one thing that is certain, Scott, is that Speaker Nancy Pelosi is going to have a smaller majority to work with. Does that really change any dynamics in the chamber? Is this going to put her sort of on the hot seat now?
I think that when you're the Speaker of the House of Representatives, you're constantly on the hot seat. But this certainly makes it more challenging for her majority to accomplish things. And obviously, the Democrats appear to be united more than Republicans because of the way that they engage in communication and messaging. But the reality is that there are a lot of divisions, I think, within the Democratic caucus. So Nancy Pelosi probably has the votes to remain Speaker, but does somebody like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez step in and make a play for extractions from leadership? I think that'll be something to watch in the coming months as Pelosi does try to lock in those votes to remain Speaker.
With Republicans having chipped away now at the House majority, Scott, and of course in politics, even though the dust has certainly not settled from the past election, we look forward to the next one. Does it really make Republicans competitive in 2022 to taking majority control of the House back?
I think that those are different voter pools, and in midterms, you can certainly swing against the incumbent in the White House. So we need to keep an eye on that. I think there's going to be obviously another record set in 2 years of how much money gets spent on elections. Obviously, elections have a lot of consequences, and this was one that there was over $14 billion spent in the 2020 election, if you can believe that. And Democrat candidates and groups spent $6.9 billion of that. There's obviously a cost of the 2020 presidential election. And in the end, we think that Democrats outspent Republicans by about 82%.
With all that outspending, though, Scott, Republicans still at least held the line.
Yeah, we did really well. I think that obviously the president, like I said, was carrying people over the finish line, making their race incredibly close based on the enthusiasm at the top of the ticket. There were also toss-up races that had strong candidates that ran really good campaigns, and, you know, the voters elected them. So this was a election that we obviously can take a lot to learn from, and we should hopefully make adjustments in the future to win even more close races.
Well, next week we will certainly have more definitive answers on a lot of these races. We'll chew this over a bit more then. But for right now, we've been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, ending as usual with a few words about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. So if your listeners want to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org. You can become a member for free. Also follow us on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you again.
Thank you.
Pollsters once again failed to provide an accurate picture of the 2020 presidential and congressional races. Taking a look at that are Eric Boehm and Robbie Soav from Reason Magazine. Eric?
The media had 4 years to figure out Trump voters, but they seem to have blown it once again. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Robbie Soav. He's a colleague of mine, a senior editor at Reason Magazine, and he's the author of a piece that you can check out right now at Reason.com, looking at exactly how the media has apparently failed to understand the inner workings of the Trump voter over the past 4 years. Robbie, thanks for taking some time and joining us today.
My pleasure. Nice to talk with you.
So look, we're talking here on Thursday, mid-afternoon. We don't yet know who is going to win the presidential election. It looks like Joe Biden is ahead by a small margin in the key states that have yet to be called, but honestly, we don't know which way it's going to go. One thing that I think we can say with certainty, though, at least a small degree of certainty, is that Donald Trump, win or lose, has once again outperformed expectations.
Yeah, it's hard to reach any other conclusion, and baffling because obviously they did so last time. They, you know, the pundits thought there was basically no chance for him in 2016, and the polls showed him losing. Although there, you could point to at least the polls showed a kind of tightening race in the final days, it being decently close in the swing states. This time, while it is, again, it is in truth, it is very close in many states. That was not expected based on the polls. The polls showed a massive, massive Biden blowout victory. So it seems to me that it's true about the shy Trump voter, or the fact that Republicans won't admit they're voting for Trump or won't talk to pollsters or media professionals or prognosticators about it. That has to be correct to some degree because, once again, they've not found these people. They've not talked to them. They've not explained their views to their audiences.
What do you make of this media blind spot here, Robbie? Is it an ideological thing? I mean, were they just seeing what they wanted to see? Was this more of a methodological problem with polling or with the media's over-reliance on polling to drive the narrative? Why was there all this talk of a Biden blowout that just obviously never materialized?
But I think it's both. I think what we've seen, obviously the media is a very broad category. We can be talking about a lot of different institutions, a lot of different places. But what I have seen over the past few years and really accelerating, you know, even over the last few months, is ideological conformity taking hold in prestigious newsrooms. And that results in a lot of weird methodological choices because there isn't as much of a commitment to understanding and explaining and presenting with some kind of neutrality or objectivity the views of people who do not exist on Twitter, who do not live in cities, who are not well-educated people, or not highly educated people. The newsrooms are increasingly captured by the woke, by the very young, ardently, stridently progressive people who don't even want their opinion pages to print op-eds from Republican senators. So that trend has increased, and I guess it's no surprise then that it's made them even more blind to what nearly half the country thinks and wants the direction of the country to be.
Yeah, it's a good point. Good point. I think we are obviously talking in some generalities here about the media. But in this case, what we mean by that is that the big legacy mainstream outlets, the New York Times, the Washington Post, places like that, all of which they do seem more ideologically monolithic than they were at times in the past. We are talking with Robbie Suave, senior editor at Reason Magazine, a fellow member of the media for sure. But look, Robbie, it's fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. This has happened twice now where the media has just kind of completely whiffed on Trump's popularity, at least with wide parts of the country. What needs to change in your mind over the next few years at these big media institutions if they're going to better understand that segment of the electorate before the next election?
Yeah, well, I mean, pollsters just should have very little credibility after this. I won't ever believe. Yeah, they had no poll showed Susan Collins being reelected. She was reelected easily, main senator. The more broadly, media analysts, the pundit class, the talking heads, the take-havers need to invest in having conversations with the other side. Again, they act like Trump voters are these troglodytes who live in cages when who lives in caves, rather, putting people in cages. But, Trump improved his vote totals among Latinos, it looks like. Maybe, adding an X to the way Latino people are talked about is what happened in elite progressive circles was not a good strategy. Talk to someone other than, like, graduates of elite colleges. That would be my advice to the media.
And just to put a final point on it here in the final minute before we go, look, it does look like Trump did much better this time around with black voters, with Latino voters, with gay and lesbian voters. And so much of what we've heard over the past few years has been about how Trump is the candidate of white supremacy, and he's about crushing these supposedly marginalized groups. But the data here doesn't really back that up. I mean, he did better with a lot of those groups this time around than he did 4 years ago.
Well, I've noticed that progressive liberal type people don't love the issue of class as much as they used to. They like race, gender, sexuality, those kinds of things are interesting. The fact that the Trump coalition is really mostly a class coalition, a coalition of the working class. And the Democrats increasingly, the coalition of kind of elite, wealthy, highly educated people is a reality that just does not lend itself well to the preferred narrative spin of many of the people who occupy the media.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, it looks like having a college degree or not really seems like maybe the biggest indicator or best indicator of whether somebody voted for Trump or Biden. I think you're right. I think it's a class issue much more than anything else. A major blind spot, obviously, and no matter whether Trump ends up winning or losing in the final count, I think it's clear that the media has some soul searching to do. You can check out more on this topic at Reason.com right now. Click over there and read Robbie's take on all this. The headline there, the media had 4 years to figure out Trump voters. They blew it. Robbie, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And again, that is Robbie Suave, senior editor at Reason Magazine. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Getting rid of undesirables. That is the genesis of the pro-abortion movement. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has this American Radio Journal commentary.
Frankly, said Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I had thought that at the time Roe was decided, there was concern about population growth, and particularly growth in populations that we don't want to have too many of. So the Roe was going to be then set up for Medicaid funding for abortion. Ruth Bader Ginsburg offered that assessment in a July 2009 interview in the New York Times Magazine, a piece titled The Place of Women on the Court. Such was the place of women on the high court, in her view, to advance such concerns. In fact, it begs the question, who are these populations that RBG and allies don't want to have too many of? Well, naturally, the Times reporter never bothered to ask. RBG admirers conveniently chose to ignore her highly offensive statement. And yet, it's a question that should be asked, certainly well after the death of Ginsburg and the positive tributes. It seems especially pertinent given that Ginsburg has now been formally replaced by Justice Amy Coney Barrett, mother of seven, including a Down syndrome children and two adopted children from Haiti. Barrett evidently doesn't share the same dismal view of Roe. Ginsburg saw in Roe a great added utility. Not only could it give women the right to abortion, but it could open the way for the federal government via Medicaid to fund abortions of undesired populations. That was very much the view of racial eugenicist Margaret Sanger, founder of Planned Parenthood, an organization that was a staunch advocate of Justice Ginsburg. Sanger, who in May 1926 spoke to a rally of the women's chapter of the KKK in Silver Lake, New Jersey, was committed to a vision of race improvement. She wanted to purge the population of what she called imbeciles and human weeds. She condemned America's race of degenerates, its dead waste of human waste. The most urgent problem today, insisted Sanger, is how to limit and discourage the overfertility of the mentally and physically defective. These were the populations that she didn't want to have too many of. Margaret Sanger preached a unique segregation. In her 1922 landmark book, The Pivot of Civilization, Sanger urged that, quote, every feeble-minded girl or woman of the hereditary type, especially of the moron class, should be segregated during the reproductive period. Otherwise, she's almost certainly to bear imbecile children, who in turn are just as certain to breed other defectives, unquote. Carefully planned segregation, Margaret Sanger insisted, was necessary. And yet, she agonized, segregation carried out for one or two generations would give us only partial control of the problem. Thus, carefully planned sterilization, likewise, was necessary. Sanger insisted, quote, we prefer the policy of immediate sterilization, of making sure that parenthood is absolutely prohibited to the feeble-minded, unquote. It was imperative, said Planned Parenthood's matron, that the nation become fully cognizant of the burden of the imbecile upon the whole human race. Funds should be made available, she counseled, quote, by hundreds of millions of dollars for the care and segregation of men, women, and children who never should have been born, unquote. That is, the populations we don't want to have too many of, as RBG would have said. In 2020, Margaret Sanger's Planned Parenthood, America's leading abortion provider, led the effort to demand a no vote on Amy Coney Barrett, insisting that this court seat was RBG's court seat. Barrett, howled Planned Parenthood, would take health care coverage away from millions. That's that Medicaid funding for abortion that RBG spoke of, for those populations that we don't want to have too many of. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the ugly eugenic skeleton in the progressive closet. Liberals would like you to ignore it, but it's there, and worse, it's not merely a skeleton. It remains alive in the worldview of far too many abortion supporters. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliates, WYAY-FM in Wilmington, North Carolina, along with WPGI-FM in Charleston, South Carolina. Welcome to our new listeners in the Tar Heel and Palmetto states. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.